Donald Trump is threatening huge tariffs and maybe worse if America doesn't get to control Greenland. So is America actually going to use military force to acquire Greenland? And what does this mean for the future of the free world? Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your libertarian review of news and politics from the editors of Reason Magazine and friends. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and today I'm joined by my colleague, Matt Welch, as well as special guests, Reem Ibrahim and Kat Rosenfield. Thank you all for joining us. So on Monday, the Danish foreign minister, whose name I am not going to try to pronounce, Lars Løkke Rasmussen. Nope, I did it wrong. That's why I'm not going to try to pronounce it. The Danish foreign minister was asked if Trump was going to invade Greenland. And here was his response. You can't leave anything out until the president himself has decided to leave anything out. Basically, Europe is not ruling this out until Trump explicitly rules it out. So Matt, I want to start with you. Is this something you can rule out? Is Donald Trump actually going to take America to war or use military force to get control of Greenland?
You absolutely cannot rule it out when the most powerful person in America, someone who has described himself recently as being constrained only by his own morality, let it sink in, is repeatedly making threats and really bad memes and saying these awful things to actual treaty allies of the United States is, and he's doing this in the face of a Congress that hasn't done anything to thwart him at all for the duration of his 1 year back in office. So no, they should totally take it seriously. And Congress should take it seriously by going into session immediately and passing a veto-proof majority saying, don't do that.
Yeah. So, Kat, over the weekend, Trump texted the prime minister of Norway. And there's this, I mean, this has been going around, right? But he's demanding that America get control of Greenland here. And the opening line from that text is just incredible. The White House confirms this is real. Just like, I know there's been some question online, but this is absolutely real, according to the White House. The opening line from that text is, considering your country decided not to give me the Nobel Peace Prize for having stopped 8 wars plus, I no longer feel an obligation to think purely of peace. And he says something about how, like, maybe he's still going to think about peace as, like, maybe one thing that he's thinking about. But that sounds an awful lot like a military threat. And it also seems like, it seems like this whole thing is happening because Donald Trump is mad that he didn't get a Nobel Peace Prize. What? I don't even know how to process this. What world are we living in, Kat? Explain it to me.
I just am surprised that you're surprised.
I'm not surprised. I'm just in shock that this is actually happening.
Yeah, this is where I am, shocked but not surprised. All of this is very much in character for Donald Trump, who, I mean, I will say, I think that he is, as he is getting older, losing impulse control, as people tend to do. Not that he ever had much to begin with. So the thing is, we're going to probably see more of this.
There are pills for that.
Yeah, well, you know, not enough pills in the world for this particular man, I don't think. But I've just never been so grateful that it's not actually my job to understand geopolitics. So I'm just very focused on the Trump text messages, especially the ones that he's revealing from other world leaders to him that he's just like posting screenshots of in the middle of the night. I want to see
group chats going crazy.
I want to see the group chat where they're all making fun of the British prime minister. I want to see the demure nudes that other world leaders have sent him. I am on tenterhooks. It's going to happen.
People were really mad about the Mark Andreessen text chats, right? I guess half of the sort of independent journalists in the world were on, and Mark Andreessen, right? People like, they're controlling. No, apparently this is now how diplomacy works, right? This is now how we are making decisions about whether or not we're going to use the United States' military to invade Greenland or not. Reem, you live in the UK. You probably follow European politics closer than I do anyway. So I just want you to give us like a kind of a sense of what is the mood there? How are people taking this? But also talk us through a little bit about like what Trump's tariffs mean in terms of the tariff threat, in terms of like how does that change the relationship between the United States and Europe?
Well, I think most people think it's absolutely insane. Most people think that this has all just sort of come out of nowhere and that, you know, a lot of the policies that this administration had come out with that most European countries wouldn't dare do was sort of like, well, you know, oh, that's the Americans. But even considering invading a NATO ally is just was not on the cards. And I think most people are really surprised by this, partly because when you look at the actual facts, the United States already has effectively all of the control that it possibly could want. If it is the case that the reason why Trump is doing this or saying he wants Greenland is for military reasons, it's for sort of national security reasons, because the United States military already has completely free use of the Pituffik military base in Greenland. And there was a 1951 treaty that effectively said the US is allowed to establish new bases in Greenland whenever they wanted to, if it is deemed necessary by NATO. So they already
and
have
leaders there are reiterating this,
that
like the United States can just come and plant whatever they want. Like if that is your actual concern, just build the base. We don't care. It's fine. Put the troops there. We don't care. It's fine. So what's this about?
Exactly. Like you, like the United States government already has significant power, especially when it comes to sort of for national security reasons. I mean, the US does in large part fund a lot of NATO. And so a lot of that support does come from that perspective. But from a European perspective, what's really happening is, you know, the approach has always been with Trump that we want to be friends, that we want to be friends with the Americans, especially the UK. The special relationship is so important, you know, post-Brexit, we're now 10 years on from the EU referendum where the UK voted to leave the EU. And a lot of it is our relationship with our American cousins. And yet this entire situation has really soured the relationship. But what's interesting is seeing European leaders step up and start saying, actually, hold on a minute, we are not going to follow along with this. Even Nigel Farage, the leader of Reform UK, who is probably the sort of political party leader that is closest to Trump, I suppose ideologically, but also just personally. And even he has come out and said, this is mental and no, we do not support it. So what's interesting is the sort of reaction has been, okay, no, like this is a step too far. In terms of the tariffs, as we know, free trade makes us all richer. And every time you impose a tariff, you are making it more difficult for American consumers to buy products from across the world. So I think what I find interesting about a lot of the coverage is the question is the impact on Europe or the impact on the countries that the tariffs are being implemented on. But it's actually you guys that are paying for it on your imports. So that is, doesn't seem to really talked about. The impact could be financially devastating for a lot of countries, especially when you think about the politics of this. The UK was the first country to get what you might call a free trade agreement. I don't think it was a free trade agreement. It was an agreement, barely free trade, but it did have some resemblance of a sort of relationship being built on economic ties. And the implementation of these tariffs would just be mental. I personally don't think they will be implemented, but I suppose only time can tell. We'll see what happens next month.
Even if they're not implemented, what does this tell us, Reem, about Donald Trump as a negotiating partner? Because there were trade deals that were negotiated, right? The whole point of these tariff threats that we saw earlier this year, or I guess or in 2025, right? The Liberation Day tariff threats. The point was, all of his supporters said, we're going to get deals out of this. This is how you make a deal with a foreign country. And then some deals were made. And what Trump is now saying is, I don't care. I'm just going to go back on those deals because I want Greenland for national security reasons, but also, I guess, just because I want to have it, because, the national security justification doesn't make any sense since we can already put any troops that we want there. So how do they think about him as a negotiating partner? How does that change sort of his stature there?
Well, the rules of the game don't follow. I mean, everybody's been saying, read the art of the deal, that Trump is a negotiator. He'll go further and then he'll meet somewhere in the middle with a compromise. I mean, what this does say is that when you do negotiate a deal, a year later or less than a year later, it can be completely reneged upon. And actually, his sort of hissy fit over not getting this Nobel Peace Prize, even though we literally saw the winner give it to him, or at least we know that she offered to give it to him, this entire situation has meant that he wants, or is he considering, military action. It is insane, but it also means that a lot of other world leaders no longer respect Trump and no longer suspect the American administration. I mean, let's be clear about this. It will take years to repair the damage that has occurred this year as a result of this negotiation over Greenland. It will take years to repair those relationships because what Trump has done is effectively say, we are not on the same level playing field. We do not negotiate as partners. NATO, the entire NATO structure, the idea that in the West, we are going to support one another. That is not the case here. And can I just add, Trump is apparently saying that, you know, Russian influence is part of why he is doing this and, you know, these national security reasons. But Trump wants Putin on his Gaza committee, and he has drastically undermined Ukrainian air defenses at the peak of winter, where, you know, they are making enormous, enormous moves. The infrastructure is as bad as it possibly could be. And Russia is loving the fact that there are these splits in the Western alliance. Of course, Russia is loving this. And, you know, we're looking at NATO's massive Arctic coast, you know, the strongest sort of cold weather militaries alongside the US. Who is it controlled by? It is Canada, Norway, Finland, it is the UK, Iceland, and of course, Denmark. So Trump is not doing anything in the US's interests by alienating basically the entirety of NATO.
Matt, I want to talk about that aspect of things, that sort of how this plays into Putin's hands or doesn't. And I want to relate it back to what Rim said about all of the conservatives, even people who are supporters of Donald Trump in Europe, thinking he's gone mental. So there's this Daniel Hannan tweet over the weekend that I thought put things really in perspective. And for those who don't know, Hannan's a conservative politician, writer from the UK, very pro-market, friendly with reason, someone who has not in any way been a knee-jerk Trump critic. You cannot accuse him of being a TDS haver. And here is part of what he tweeted over the weekend. I've trimmed this down just a bit. A lot of good people are on a hook over Donald Trump. They voted for him for understandable reasons, right? So he starts out by saying, I get why you might like Donald Trump. There are good reasons for this. And then he says, but Trump has plainly now lost his mind. There is no other way of reading, I am going to threaten an ally with invasion because I didn't get the Nobel Peace Prize. If Putin had put an agent in the White House, what would be done differently? Matt, what do you make of this? Like, again, what are we supposed to do about this? But also, what are European leaders supposed to do?
I like Daniel Hannan. He's a good follow, and I appreciate his contributions over the last couple of weeks, in particular, of being pretty vocal in his criticism and blunt about Donald Trump. And I didn't think that was a very good tweet. And that's because the line of, oh, he's plainly lost his mind. Okay. He would just bring Greenland up in 2019? This isn't the first time with Greenland. He was talking about deporting U.S. citizen children of illegal immigrants in 2015. He was saying Mexico emptied their prisons of rapists and sent this to us bigger than the Mariel boat lift. So that in 2015, that was like his opening bid, talking about shooting his supporters on Fifth Avenue, and they'd still support him.
Well, okay. I think he said he could shoot someone and then his supporters would like it.
Yeah, well, whatever.
It wasn't necessarily that he was
a murder.
Shoot a MAGA person.
An open murder. Yes. Maybe that's not crazy because he was describing the truth. But it still sounds crazy for those of us who are not his supporters and inclined to follow him there. I don't think that he's suddenly gone crazy. I think that he's had a hell of a hell of a last 72 hours for sure. And you know, we should have taken the keys away from Grandpa quite a long time ago. But I'm not persuaded that he is as obviously unfit as, let's say, Joe Biden was, just in terms of basic old guy capabilities late in his presidency. And also when you say that, or when you say that he's a, you know, he's essentially, you know, Putin's puppet in the Hillary Clinton parlance, both of those things, I think, are it's a temptation to a shortcut. Oh my God, he's crazy. 25th Amendment. Let's go to the finish line without like actually working up a sweat and jogging, if he's Putin's puppet, my God, that's treasonous. I've always thought that it's a much more potentially worrying and deeper challenge to think that what if his interests are just aligned, his analysis are aligned with Putin enough, you know, 65% enough. They both don't like big multilateral institutions. They both think that it's against the interests as they perceive for their own nation. That's kind of true. And there's a lot of populist parties, which, by the way, have been gaining traction all over the European continent over the last several years, who are in broad agreement with a lot of those things. So that's a little bit more of a difficult thing than just to say, my God, he's just an agent for Vladimir Putin. It's a kind of an easy way out. To be clear,
I don't think Hannon was saying that Trump is actually an agent of Putin or that there is an agent of Putin in the White House. I think he was saying, what would be different, right? He is functionally acting as if. And this I've always understood this is Trump is obviously not in the employ of Russia. He's not a secret agent. This is not the Americans spy scenario where they got one into the White House. That's not what's happening here. But it is what you're saying here.
But the point is he might as well be, right?
Yeah. It might as well be.
You can easily accuse me and ring me up for being a bit of a literalist when it comes to historical analogies. That's why when everyone brings up Neville Chamberlain at every opportunity, I'm the guy saying nope. So he would act differently. Putin does things like bomb Kiev every day. Just kind of there's a category difference. But there's some similarities that are absolutely troubling. And the fact that right now we're talking about the United States president having this very flippant attitude towards the sovereignty of any country, let alone a NATO ally, is gobsmackingly worrying. I just want the response to be from European leaders, back to your original question, I want their response to be like, okay, maybe we're going to be in charge of our own collective security for a change. They have been saying, how many summits have we seen over the last 5 to 8 years, whatever. I'm losing track of time. That they've said, okay.
It's just the Europeans love summits so much.
This time it's serious. We're really going to have to be in charge of defending Ukraine. And to be clear, Denmark has provided as much per capita support for defending Ukraine as any country in Western Europe. But overall, Europe has not responded to the actual existential threat of Donald Trump trying to dissolve NATO in 11 years. And they're not doing it today. They might send a few people, a few scragglers on a boat or a helicopter to Greenland. And I kind of appreciate the symbolism of it all. They need to do a hell of a lot more. And Americans need to take responsibility themselves for grandpa having the keys to the car. There's no such thing right now as a spectator sport of saying the institutions are going to hold. Institutions have to be made to hold by actual action, and the people who are in power and are not doing those actions should be disgraced.
Speaking of summits, what's pretty funny is that all of this is coming to a head at Davos. The Macron speech actually had kind of interesting passages, basically like America is giving up on liberalism. That is what is happening here. The rule of law, it seems like maybe it's over. And so I want to use that as a jumping off point to ask a final question to all of you here, right? People who listen to this podcast, who subscribe to Reason, who like Reason, a big thing that they say is, look, you keep your calm, you're level-headed, you don't panic, you don't have TDS, right? You don't you think before reacting with hysteria. But it does seem like with what's going on with Greenland right now, among other things, Donald Trump is on the verge of destroying the Western alliance that propped up the free world for the last 80 years. And he's doing it because he's throwing a fit about not getting a peace prize. And the domestic situation doesn't seem too much better. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But Kat, I'll start with you. What level of alarm is appropriate here?
Well, I mean, after having just listened to Matt's, very nice exposition about this, I am very tempted to just say, guys, I got to go and dig a bunker in my basement. And, I'll see you after the apocalypse, maybe.
Yeah, in Donald Trump's America, you can't get people to do home renovations because he's deporting all of them.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, because of the tariffs, do you have any idea how expensive it would be for me to make a root cellar made out of reinforced concrete? Like, anti-radiation equipment, like hazmat suits, through the roof. They're up like 10,000% in cost.
Even if you just want to put a wafer cabinet in there, you can't afford it anymore.
Yeah, it's very true. So how alarmed should I be? I don't know. I mean, I'm more alarmed now than I was 10 minutes ago or so when we started talking about this. And I'm just going to retreat on that front into hopeless optimism and be like, look, you know, we have another few years of this. Maybe at the end, the rest of the world will forgive us if we come out with a really like elegantly worded apology and send them all a nice fruit basket.
It's the Derek Jeter approach.
Reem, is that going to work? Is the fruit basket approach going to fix things? What's your panic level?
I mean, I personally like the idea of a fruit basket, although maybe some wine in addition to that might sweeten the spot. I mean, Matt alluded to this.
Donald Trump is threatening
French
wine producers with 200% tariffs. French wine is already in a load of trouble. But this is part of what he's doing to try and get the EU to give him Greenland.
Well, also, no offense, but American wine is terrible. I've never had a nice... Well, I mean, in Virginia, it's okay. But, I mean, California wine, not as good as European.
Wait, that's exactly really backwards. The Virginia wine is terrible.
Is that what we're
California
calling?
California wine's good. Yeah.
I've never had a good glass of American wine. But what is interesting is that there obviously are mechanisms in place in the American Constitution that can allow for things to change. So, I mean, is it currently the case that the Supreme Court are looking at the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act, the sort of act that he's continuously using to do a lot of this crazy tariff stuff? And I think that obviously a lot of that is currently remaining unaddressed, but Congress can, I think Matt alluded to this earlier, Congress can pass a resolution denying war powers for a war in Greenland. Ultimately, Trump can, of course, use executive power to veto it if he wanted to. But again, Congress can be serious. They can do things. They can deny basically all future funding bills. They can sort of say, you know what, any funding that is being used to fight NATO allies, I cannot believe we are saying this, but any funding used to fight NATO allies can be stopped. And the Senate can stop confirming appointments until the president agrees to this. You know, there are things, there is a way to check executive power in the American Constitution. That's one of the things that makes it so great. And there are things to do. Can I use the word, the bad word, impeachment? I mean, there are mechanisms that exist. I know it's an icky word, but there are mechanisms that exist for these exact situations. And Congress can pass all the resolutions, all the laws, all the funding bills. But if the president is lawless and it will not prosecute or it will pardon the wrongdoers, then impeachment has to be on the table.
If a Democratic president was doing any of this, a Republican Congress would have impeached him already. Matt, what's your panic level?
I've always thought that this 12 months, the 12 months before the midterm elections, is always going to be the biggest stress test that Donald Trump was going to pose to the American and international system, because Republicans are still going to be cowed of his power, at least up until that midterm. His popularity is going to be decreasing. And since this is his final term, he's going to be like, screw it. Might as well do it now. And so that stress test is literally this week. I mean, the Supreme Court could be coming out with a ruling on tariffs. There might be 1,500 airborne troops in Minneapolis. What? Going on. So there's a whole lot of things to be concerned with. I am not panicked at all. This is America. We always win.
Okay, let's move on. But before we do, reminder that we have a Reason Roundtable live show coming up very soon right here in Washington, D.C. Matt Welch, Catherine Mengu Ward, Nick Gillespie, and yours truly will be talking about the news, arguing with each other and perhaps ourselves, and answering your questions at the D.C. Improv on February 4th. It's going to be fun and feisty, and you should be there. More details and tickets at reason.com/events. That's reason.com/events. Come watch us talk about the news. Ask us questions. All right. While we're on the subject of places that are cold and covered in ice, let's talk about Minnesota. So in the aftermath of the Rene Good killing, the state continues to have this masked army of federal agents just running around, taking people into custody, sometimes detaining or tackling them for no obvious reason. And the video evidence continues to suggest that the killing of Renee Good was unnecessary and unjustified. This seems like a libertarian nightmare in miniature, like in test, in beta almost, in Minneapolis here. So, Kat, I want to start with you. Local leaders have sued the Trump administration. Basically, their argument is that the Trump administration's intent is to provoke a showdown. And if you go back to the rollout of the National Guard in Los Angeles, the various dust-ups with protesters in Portland, it really does seem like so much of what we have seen from the Trump administration in terms of immigration enforcement and sort of this kind of violent action in the street for the last year is intended to be provocative and get people riled up. What do you think about this?
I mean, I think everybody is trying to rile everybody up. It's like everybody on every side is doing LARPing civil war as though it's not going to have actual consequences. And the thing that I've been fascinated by on this front is how people seem to just inhabit completely different realities when it comes to like how they're experiencing what is happening, what they think the motivations are, what they think the stakes are. I do think that the Trump administration is treating this as though they are like cosplaying Rambo meets the bully in a 1980s teen movie. It's incredibly like disturbing to see. About 30 to 45 minutes ago, Donald Trump was standing at a podium. I don't know if you guys saw this, doing a press conference where he was just showing flyers, printouts from the DHS website. It's worst of the worst. It looks, the graphics look like they were designed by the guy who was doing the on-screen graphics for like the Maury Povich, You Are Not the Father segments back in the 1990s. Like this is the level of seriousness with which this information is being presented. Yeah. I'm way too young to remember that. It just, you know, I absorbed it from the ether. But like, so
you saw the clips on YouTube.
Exactly. The DHS is, you know, choosing to narrativize this in a way that makes them look like they're not taking it that seriously, that they think they can just, you know, play the kind of provocateur and it's not going to come back to bite them. The thing is, I think that a lot of local officials in Minneapolis are doing the very same thing. You know, Tim Walz and Jacob Frey, like, or is it Fry? Well, whatever it is. They
F-R-E-Y.
Are.
Y. However you pronounce that.
Yes. So, you know, they're engaged in equally inflammatory rhetoric. They're like riling up their constituents. They're giving the sense, I think, that this is all kind of like a game that is being played against cartoon Nazis as opposed to actual agents of the state who have actual guns that they will use to actually shoot you if you get in their way. And all of this is a long-winded way of saying that I do think that the intent is to provoke conflict and confrontation, and that nobody is taking that as seriously as they should be.
So I take your point to some degree about Frey, right? I mean, he's gotten, you know, people have gotten mad. He dropped some F-bombs, things like that. But his response, I thought, you know, it's like, I'm dropping F-bombs. They're tackling people in the streets and they killed an American citizen. These are not the same. Do you think that there is anything like, I mean, I guess my question is here, on the one hand, yes, of course, Tim Walz has a responsibility to act like a non-ridiculous person, which is hard for him. Of course, Frey has a responsibility to be a good political leader. At the same time, it just sort of seems to me like the emphasis should be on what Trump is doing, on the masked goons in the street who are killing Americans, who are tackling people, who are engaging in all sorts of unconstitutional action.
So the thing about Frey and Walz is, you know, they are being listened to by their constituents. You know, Minneapolis, you know, people who live in Minneapolis are listening to them. People in Minneapolis are not taking their cues from Donald Trump or from DHS or from Kristi Noem. They're not in moral community with these people. They already see them as an enemy. And I do think that it's incredibly irresponsible for local officials who know that they are being listened to by their constituents to get up at a podium and say things that encourage these types of confrontations that are very likely to end in violence. The other thing, too, is that the only reason, well, I shouldn't say the only reason, but a big reason why Renee Good was able to be where she was, why she was able to drive right into the middle of this operation that was happening on a Minneapolis street and interpose herself in such a way that she unwittingly, I think, put her life in danger with incredibly tragic results, is that Frey pulled back the Minneapolis cops. They were instructed not to involve themselves in ICE operations, especially not to do crowd control. And that leaves the citizens defenseless against these agents, again, who don't have their best interests at heart, who are not in community with them, who have a different job that they're doing, whether you agree with it or not. Like, they're not the people who should be, that's not who Renee Good should be meeting when she goes out in the street. She should be meeting a police officer who has her best interests at heart, whose job it is to serve and protect her and to keep her from ending up in a confrontation where she misunderstands the stakes and ends up getting shot.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that the local police should be doing their job, but I guess I also think that ICE should be capable of restraining someone like that who is not obviously trying to hurt them. Like that, just like look at the video evidence. She was trying to get away. They should be able to do that without killing her. Reem, how is this playing in the UK? How is this playing in Europe? You guys more looking at Americans
well,
and thinking,
we're seeing...
well, more evidence you're crazy.
Well, basically, yes. I mean, we're seeing the videos online circulating and just thinking, oh, that's a lot. And I mean, even on very, very sort of right-wing spaces where people are saying, oh, I wish we had Trump doing what, you know, what the Americans are doing with ICE in the UK, because, as you know, sort of illegal migration in the UK has surged significantly over the last few years. It's actually declining now, partly as a result of some of the quite restrictive policies the government have implemented.
Did you manage to restrict immigration in the UK? Did you manage to restrict immigration in the UK without a bunch of masked thugs running around shoving people on the ground? Did that happen?
We did, but not for very good reasons. I mean, the immigration we've restricted is exactly the immigration that people generally want. I mean, we still have, you know, illegal crossings, people crossing on illegal boats from the Channel, from France to Dover in the UK. But and then those are the very people that, generally speaking, when people talk about immigration, they don't want the small boat people. But the immigration we've actually restricted is the legal migration, those that are actually doing the jobs that Brits don't want to do. So unfortunately, I think we're actually going to end up with the worst of both worlds. I've said this before, I think that just as a side note, in the UK, when we will end up restricting immigration, perhaps even to net sort of negative migration levels, especially if reform get a majority, and we will be so much worse off for it. I don't think people realise that all of the problems, the housing crisis, the economic stagnation, all of those things will still exist when immigration is in negative numbers. It actually will be worse because there won't be jobs being filled. Anyway, that's a side point. What's interesting is the incentive structures with regard to ICE and their relationship with individual people. I mean, I personally think it is perfectly responsible, sort of reasonable to treat large-scale federal bodies with an enormous sort of monopoly of violence with a degree of scrutiny. You always have to question that authority. And I saw this piece on reason.com, the idea that ICE agents do not have absolute immunity from state prosecution. It's, I mean, it's obviously a mental situation. ICE is acting entirely lawlessly and obviously exceeding its mandate, but it's the incentive structures. They appear to be awarded for arrests rather than arrests that actually lead to lawful deportations. So when you are rewarding for just simply the number of arrests you actually obtain, then the incentives are totally off and you're actually incentivized to arrest innocent or so-called innocent people that actually aren't doing anything wrong. And what you have now is this sort of papers, please sort of culture that has emerged, I think, in Minneapolis, where you and I suppose across the rest of America, where you have to prove to the state who you are and whether or not you have the right to be there. And it's sort of not great for freedom, I suppose.
It's not great for freedom, and it's just gross and un-American. That's not what America is. That's not what it should be. That's not what it ever has been, but that's what it's turning into under Donald Trump, but also under Stephen Miller. And Matt, that's what I want to ask you about. The piece that Rima mentioned was a response to something that Stephen Miller, the Trump advisor, senior Trump advisor, who is pretty clearly overseeing a lot of the deportation and sort of ICE action that we have seen, not just in Minnesota, but all throughout the country. How much of this just goes back to the fact that he seems to be a really ugly and unpleasant person?
Well, that has a role. Yeah. For sure. Stephen Miller's unpleasantness, and I think, and I really don't use this word hardly at all, really don't, racism, I think would be irrelevant to my life and most people's lives if it wasn't for the fact that Donald Trump affirmatively decided in 2015 or 2014, whenever he changed his mind, probably 2015, to make this the centerpiece of his political candidacy in the 2015-2016 campaign. Remember that the day after Mitt Romney lost to Barack Obama, Donald Trump gave an interview to Newsmax in which he blamed Romney's loss on his maniacal immigration policies, including this crazy idea about self-deportation. What are we doing right now? We're just doing self-deportation. I mean, all this shock and awe, and it's very clear how much ICE and the Department of Homeland Security and Trump and Stephen Miller, the troglodyte, are enjoying this. Part of it is you have 12,000 ICE officers, from what I understand. You can't possibly deport everybody. So what are you going to do? You're going to make a big, big, big stink. You're going to show people that it's scary out there, and hopefully they will self-deport themselves. So yes, a lot of this flows from Stephen Miller, who has all kinds of asinine understandings about, for instance, refugees. He has described the 1980 Refugee Act as a catastrophe for the United States of America, like where it all went wrong. And man, we'd be having flying cars if it wasn't for all the damn refugees. Fact is, in this country, refugees and asylees, right? These are the people who are in the lowliest situations before they get to this country. They match within the 10 years, they match on average the earnings of a native born citizen. And within 20 years, they start to eclipse it. So it's weird how we have had, at least up until now, this remarkable assimilation machine, even of people from terrible places like Nigeria and Iran and some of the other places that we've now just decided that, we're not going to issue visas to anymore. So he's really, really wrong about that. And that wrongness, again, wouldn't matter if Trump hadn't decided that, yes, these are my policies. So I do blame Stephen Miller, and I think he's a uniquely odious character in American life. And I'm kind of embarrassed for my country that we even know his name. But I put the responsibility on Donald Trump and the people who think that the price of effectively like stopping all border traffic, right? There was chaos at the border for a very long time under many different presidents. That chaos has now stopped. People think that the stopping of that chaos is worth what we are seeing in Minneapolis and elsewhere. It's worth like, okay, we pulled the old guy in his pajamas out in the cold and he was an American citizen, but what are you going to do? It's worth harassing Native Americans and saying their tribal IDs aren't good enough. My dudes, this is the one category of people that you maybe should just hold off on. And they're even reportedly using those people as pawns in a negotiation to do treaties with some of the tribes. Holy guacamole, what are we even thinking about? The ultimate responsibility lies in Trump and for the people who enable Trump, who are even more responsible than the absolutely odious and ugly Stephen Miller.
You know what's really funny is that Stephen Miller has, in addition to all the horrible things he's been doing, spent the weekend tweeting about Star Trek. Not making this up. He's really mad about the new Star Trek because it's woke. Okay, it does look woke and it does look terrible. But my dude, have you ever seen Star Trek? The whole thing is like leftists are right. Like Cold War liberals are right. That's the whole ethos. He doesn't even understand the thing he purports to love. This is the real problem. No, this is not the real problem with Stephen Miller, but it is indicative of the problem with Stephen Miller, is that he doesn't even understand the things he purports to support and love, including, I think, America. All right, with that, we're going to take a break to an ad. We're going to be right back here with a question. We're going to come back to Greenland, find out what libertarians think about that. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. The new year doesn't require a new you, but maybe it requires a less burdened you. And therapy can help. Therapy helps identify what weighs you down, what holds you back. It offers an unbiased perspective to better understand your relationships, your motivations, and your emotions. If you're afraid, if you're putting too much pressure on yourself every day, then therapy can help. And BetterHelp has so many benefits. Quality therapists, therapist match commitment. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. So the way it works is there's a short questionnaire, helps identify your needs and your preferences. And then with 12 years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate, BetterHelp pretty much gets it right on the first time. But if you are not happy with your therapist match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time from many tailored recommendations. The client reviews show that it works. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is one of the world's largest online therapy platforms. It served over 5 million people globally already, and it works. There's an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. BetterHelp makes it easy to get matched online with a qualified therapist. If you sign up, you can get 10% off at betterhelp.com/roundtable. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. All right. Reminder, we love to answer your questions as long as they are short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long. You can email us at podcasts@reason.com. That's podcasts@reason.com. If you want us to answer one of your questions on the show, this week's listener question comes from Alexander, and it is, in fact, short, pithy, succinct, and otherwise not very long. Alexander says that he read an article in the Financial Times, that's a British paper, about how Trump really wants Greenland. So, do libertarians want Greenland? Matt Welch, I don't know if you call yourself a libertarian or not today, because it's a day ending and why, but you did edit a libertarian magazine for a bunch of years. Do libertarians want Greenland?
I don't speak for libertarians. That was my condition of taking the job. But I will describe myself as one just because it's easier to do that. I'll speak for myself on this. No, I don't want Greenland, just like Americans don't want Greenland. It's a something like a 60-2/3 issue. Americans are against not just like invading it, but like buying it. We don't want Greenland because we're not an imperialist country, or at least we are telling ourselves that we're not an imperialist country, and we don't want to just expand American territory. Recall that when Trump came to office in his first day, when he renamed Mount McKinley, he praised him initially by saying he expanded American territory. Yes, 1898. We're going to do it all over again. Americans really don't want it. Rand Paul once told me that you always want to be on the right side of an 80-20 issue in this country. Invading, seizing, using the military to seize Greenland is not an 80-20 issue in America. It's an 85-10 issue in America of people.
Wait, what's the other five?
So the hell with libertarians, just in general. But Americans don't want this. This is the absolute opposite of a populist policy. It's bananas. It's going to end in ruin.
Reem, you are not currently an American, what do you think about Alexander's question? Do libertarians want Greenland? I don't know. Do market friendly people on the right in the UK want America to have? No, I guess the answer is no, right? We covered this.
Definitely not. I mean, the first thing I'd say is you kind of already have it. Like, for every all intents and purposes, if you want to set up bases, you can. So Americans, do you want Greenland? You already have it. You already have it for every reason you could possibly want it for. As a libertarian, and I do identify very strongly with the libertarian word for some reason, I think it sort of gives you a bit of an identity in a box. And I like a comfortable box. And definitely not. I mean, all sort of aspects of this I don't think work very well. Either American taxpayers are forced to fork out huge amounts of money to pay Greenlanders in order for it to be a legal purchase. In that case, you know, it's less egregious than military action. But from a libertarian perspective, I don't think spending literally trillions of American taxpayer dollars is really the way forward. And again, if you want to use it for military bases, you already have that right. What is I don't understand any of this. This is just basically a hissy fit. It's an international global power sort of two-year-old having a tantrum.
Kat, you can answer this question directly about libertarians if you want. But also, maybe what I want to ask you is, why would an American or a libertarian want Greenland? Is there any good reason at all?
I mean, you're asking me to put myself in the mind of a libertarian, which I'm trying to do, and then like extend myself further to imagine how a libertarian might want Greenland. I don't know. I mean, I myself have, I guess, maybe some small L libertarian ideals, but I also saw a tweet once that said, I can't go full libertarian because stupid people deserve better than this. And that kind of rang a bell inside of me.
That got a laugh from Matt Welch.
She's funny.
To answer the question, I mean, I don't know. I guess this kind of goes back to my sense that nobody really understands the stakes of anything we're doing at this point. We're all just too online. Everybody's LARPing. Everybody's tweeting. Nobody's really thinking about like how this all plays out in real physical space. And so people are just kind of like, yeah, you know, military imperialism sounds fun. Maybe we can have a little bit of that as a treat. And all I'm going to say is, if we're going to do that, I think that we should not put our eyes on Greenland, which is, you know, proximate to us and, you know, too accessible ultimately. Let's like dream a little bigger. Let's annex the moon.
Oh,
I mean, I think you can buy parts of the moon now.
Really?
I think it's just private property. I don't know if anybody owns the moon.
You can buy the moon's private parts.
I think there's an international treaty that prevents this, but I'm not. Oh man. Yeah, the man in the moon brings her.
You've been watching too much.
What's that little crater there? I don't know.
Like the minions.
All right. I think we need to move on here to something maybe a little bit more serious, but I'm not sure how that serious it is, because Donald Trump has a new healthcare plan. In case you were confused about what he wanted you to think about it, it is called the Great Healthcare Plan. Well, what makes it great? It's hard to say because there's so few details, but broadly speaking, does a couple of things, right? It improves transparency, theoretically, tries to increase patients' control over the money that they spend on healthcare, and tries to make sure that people have improved access to medications without having to get prescriptions, which is in some ways a good thing. So Matt, I want to start with you. Is this actually a great plan? And what about Rand Paul's healthcare plan, which seems like it's actually legislation that you
can legislation pass? Is definitely preferable because that's how laws are supposed to be made in the United States. So I do appreciate that Rand Paul is sort of working on it. Donald Trump issuing 4 bullet points in year 5 of his presidency with a congressional majority of 2 nose hairs, while his approval ratings scrape the high 30s and he does batshit things like threaten to invade Greenland, doesn't seem pretty high on the probability list that that stuff is going to be translated into policies. Although one of those as someone who does not understand my own healthcare plan at all, not even a little bit. I've spent some time trying to look into it. But hey, having more prescription drugs be available over the counter, that sounds good. Like, I don't know, the birth control pill. That would be great. More of that. And Rand Paul's is like, let's expand and allow greater numbers on health savings accounts. That sounds good to my very simple, not very comprehending brain. Although I would point out that the person who writes the most about healthcare on this podcast is the one who asked me a question about it, Peter. So I'm sure we'd like to hear from you as well.
My job is to ask the questions here, and Rand Paul's plan is obviously superior because it's a real plan. Donald Trump, after all of these years, still only has concepts of a plan. That's what he promised, right? When he was running for president the second time, was we have concepts of a plan. I'm like, dude, you have been promising a plan since 2015 in the debates when you praised socialized medicine. You were like, actually, that seems kind of great. Which brings me to my question, which is for Reem. Are there any lessons for American healthcare from the NHS?
No. And I actually wrote a piece for Reason.com at the beginning of this year on this very, very issue. The National Health Service is one of the worst healthcare systems out there, partly because, I mean, you know, pharmaceuticals are extraordinarily expensive, but the NHS spends an enormous amount of money. We spend about £200 billion a year on the NHS. And we have at least in the year before the pandemic, we had the second highest avoidable mortality rates in all of Western Europe. The NHS is basically the last relic of the Soviet Union. It's proof that socialism did once occur and that the United Kingdom has fallen for lots of it. I mean, it's really awful when you think about the fact that there are people that are dying that perhaps didn't need to die as a result of this broken healthcare system. And when I look at the American healthcare system, partly Matt says he doesn't understand what his own health insurance plan looks like, it's extraordinarily complicated. However, you do have some element of choice. In the UK, you don't have choice. And I hope that that is, at least in some case, a warning for the rest of the world that the NHS is not something to be envied, not in the slightest. It's not only extremely expensive, but patients do not get choice. You have no autonomy. You have no freedom over your own healthcare needs. You are told by government bureaucrats what you can and cannot do. And funnily enough, only the wealthy have choice because they decide to go private. They often go abroad for their healthcare needs. And so if you are very wealthy, very wealthy, you have choice. You have choice in the market. But everybody else is stuck in the socialist healthcare system. It is almost certainly not something to be envied. What I find interesting about some of these proposals, I mean, Matt mentioned it earlier, the sort of making it easier to get sort of different actual products available on the over-the-counter, well, that will almost certainly lower the price. And I fully don't understand American healthcare systems, but I think it's better to do it that way than through your co-pays. I don't know. You guys can tell me.
I mean, the American system is a mess in so many ways. It is absolutely flawed, absolutely in need of reform. But it does many things better than Canada's system, than the British system, than a lot of the European systems. And like you said, it gives people some amount of choice. But what it really does is it allows people to that it does a better job, I think, with queuing, and it does a better job with specialist care. And you look at cancer mortality rates, like if you have a very serious specialized form of cancer, you are better off in the United States on average than you are in most of these European countries. Yeah, we don't constrain healthcare spending, but it's just going to destroy the budget. That is true, and it needs reform, and we need to figure out how to do that. Donald Trump's plan isn't really going to get us there at all. But there is a system that is outside of the government system, at least to some extent. Obamacare made that less true. And Obamacare continues to be just kind of a mess, I think, both as a sort of as a administrative program, sort of from a kind of top-down perspective, as well as for many of the individuals who are on it. So I'm glad to see that Donald Trump is at least talking about reforming the healthcare system, but I have no confidence at all that any of this is ever going to be passed into law or is it going to come to fruition. There's just not nearly enough detail, not nearly enough evidence of thinking or caring about this actual issue, which is, in fact, my question for you, Kat. What does it tell us that Donald Trump is so fixated on stuff that isn't domestic policy right now? I mean, immigration, yes, a little bit, but international issues really seem to be driving his presidency. And he was elected. If you look at the polls, it's very clear he was elected by people who were upset with Joe Biden's economy. And many of those people, the swing voters who voted for Joe Biden and then voted for Donald Trump, they are upset with Donald Trump's economy right now, and he's out there threatening to use military force to take Greenland.
Yeah, can I just say thank you for not asking me about healthcare policy, which is a subject I know nothing about. I was like, I have an art degree, please. I have no opinions on that.
What I actually want to talk about is the intricacies of whether Medicare recovery audit contractors.
I'm going to break out in hives all over my face if we continue down this path. No, let's talk about why Donald Trump is ignoring domestic policy and instead choosing to, you know, try to invade Greenland, because I do have as a novelist and a culture writer, more of a theory of mind for why people do what they do. And I do think I have a decent theory of mind for why Donald Trump does what he does, which is just basically what he does is what he wants to do. And I don't think that he's all that interested in domestic policy. He never has been. He was interested in winning the popularity contest of the election, but he does not care about the people who voted for him or what they care about. And what he's concerned about most now is, like, what is my legacy? How are people going to write about me when I'm gone? And I think he does have this fantasy of being like the greatest president ever. You know, people are going to remember him as this incredible leader who did all of these things, things that people said couldn't be done. And the more
I don't think
he
thinks of it as a fantasy. I think he thinks of it as the current reality.
I think he thinks of it as his destiny, maybe. Yeah. And, you know, it's a... This would be a charming delusion if it were like my child who had it. I would be like, it's so sweet of you to think that. It's adorable. You know, keep dreaming, big boy. But this is the president of the United States, and I don't feel quite as great about it. But I do think that this is ultimately about Donald Trump wanting things all the more for being told that he can't do them or can't have them. And he is like our oppositional defiant president. And that's just who we've got right now.
I like how you are offering a theory of mind as a novelist, because there's been this conversation, I don't know if you've seen over the past couple of days, actually, amongst like psychologists, psychiatrists, right? Clinically trained people who have this thing where they're not supposed to diagnose someone from afar unless they've actually done the interviews and like gone through the medical, you know, sort of requirements, which are totally reasonable, by the way. But it means they can't come out and say Donald Trump is probably clinically a narcissist or whatever, right? Like, it means they're not supposed to do that. But you, as a novelist, no rules apply to you.
That's right. I can do anything I want. I even kill people all the time. I mean, fictionally.
I'm going to clip that. That is going to be the moment that we put on Instagram that everybody sees. I can do whatever I
want.
I
am going to jail
all the time. I even kill people. Kat Rosenfield, thank you for being on this show. Speaking of novels and movies, television, we always end our show, of course, with cultural recommendations. So let's go through the panel and talk about our cultural recommendations for this week. Matt Welch, let's start with you.
So I saw a 1979 movie that I never saw in my life before, because when it came out, I was 11 years old and it was rated R. It's about football. It's called North Dallas 40. And it's sort of like a fictional Dallas Cowboys, and it's one of those 70s sports movies that rips the lid off the kind of scuzzy underbelly of professional sports. Therefore, it is very enjoyable for that reason. It's no Bad News Bears, because what could be, frankly, or slapstick? Maybe it's more equivalent to The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh, for those who like deep cuts and Gabe Kaplan movies. What is fun to watch in it these days is that it's like a lot of these 70s movies, the guys, and this is actually like 70s sports in general, the guys' bodies are just kind of, it's about a sort of late career Dallas Cowboys receiver played by Nick Nolte, like a young Nick Nolte, if there ever was such a thing, and there wasn't. And
who does
just,
not
like,
exactly have a 14-pack and just, like superhero biceps.
And the quarterback is played by Mac Davis, country singer songwriter with a little perm, and who's actually quite good. Nolte's terrific. You can kind of see why he was sort of a weird leading man, at least in that time. It's fun, sort of like about the trade-offs that you make in the hypocrisies that underline professional sports and Dallas sports. And there's all kinds of just like sort of groupie party scenes that shouldn't play in 2026 anymore. And so therefore are kind of enjoyable and also like nerve rattling. And I swear to God, I'm not making this up because of this podcast, but about 45 minutes in, I pointed at the screen because there was this cute girl and I said, "Who is that?" And then I said, "That's Kat Rosenfield." And my God, it was. Kat Rosenfield was a person, a Canadian model actress, named Dale Haddon, H-A-D-D-O-N. And you can furiously Google image her cat right now to see whether that's a compliment or not. But she plays Nick Nolte's girlfriend. Very funny, just like a startling likeness. It's a good movie. It's also has that late 70s sort of like it's going too slow type of thing. Those of us for a certain age enjoy slow bits in movies as ways to build up tension and to be kind of weird. But North Dallas 40, it's based on a novel written by a former Dallas Cowboy wide receiver. Pretty fun. Check it out. And Kat Rose.
Nick Nolte, so good as the weirdo supervillain dad of the Hulk in the Ang Lee Hulk, which is a real movie that actually came out that everybody forgets about. And he just like talks like this for the whole thing. And the further you get in the movie, the harder it is to understand. And it's insane. You have no idea what he's saying at any point in the movie. And yet you're just like, yeah, that's a scary father figure. Kat Rosenfield, since you were name checked, what do you have for us?
Okay, well, I have a thank you to Matt for a very flattering comparison. I guess I can kind of see it. I think she's much more beautiful than me. This Sports Illustrated swimsuit model, apparently, before she died at some point at the age of 76. Anyway, what do I have? I'm a little late to this, but The Beast in Me on Netflix is a show about Claire Danes stars as a writer who is kind of floundering in search of her next topic. She's has a book due that she hasn't even really gotten started on. And then a man who has been accused of murdering his wife moves in next door to her, and they commence a sort of not exactly a friendship. They have a rapport. They develop a working relationship. She decides to write a book about him. I'm not going to spoil anything. But the thing that I found really fascinating about this show is that it's not especially well written. It suffers from the kind of endemic plague that a lot of post-2012 TV and movies suffer from, where it like has to restate its thesis over and over and over again because people are like watching it while also looking at their phones. But the thing that I think is amazing about it is the acting in it is phenomenal. And I watched this and I was like, this is going to be how we save ourselves from AI, because an AI cannot do with its face what Claire Danes does with hers. It is riveting.
Did you see that interview with Ben Affleck and Matt Damon? I believe it was on Joe Rogan, where they confirmed something that has been going around for a while about how Netflix actually requires screenwriters to constantly repeat the details of the plot. So just say it three or four times and the characters sort of have to go over it. Hey, what we're going to do now is we're going to rob the bank, and we're going to do it by putting on a funny hat, and then we're going to take the funny hat, and we're going to put it on the bank manager, and okay, so what are we going to do? Rob the bank with the funny hat. And they keep like doing this over and over because the assumption is that people are folding laundry, looking at their phones, not paying any attention. It's really weird when you notice that this is happening, not just on Netflix, but kind of all over now on television, where they assume that you're just only barely paying attention, and they feed you the information over and over and over. But sometimes you still get pretty good acting out of that. I'm planning to watch the Affleck Damon movie tonight, but I haven't seen it yet. Reem, what do you have?
Mine is a book that I've been reading over the Christmas and New Year period. It's called Lady Chatterley's Lover by D.H. Lawrence. And I originally came across it because it was banned in the United Kingdom when it was first published, I think in the 1920s, because of its absolute profanity. So it is all about a sexually repressed aristocratic woman who is married to a man who is basically disabled from the waist down. And so she is sexually repressed. It is a very, very sort of sad story. She becomes extremely depressed until she meets the gatekeeper. So she ends up starting an affair with somebody who is of a lower sort of class status to her. And it's sort of, I mean, it was banned because of its detailed use of language around the sort of sexual profanities. These were literally unprintable words. And I thought it was fascinating that this book was banned because it was so obscene in its language. And so I thought I must read it. And it really is a very, very beautiful book.
Huh. Well, I watched a movie that is not in any way very beautiful. It is 28 years later, The Bone Temple. So this is the fourth film in the 28 something later franchise and the third one to be written by Alex Garland, who is a screenwriter, who's also a director, who's made movies like Civil War. He also made Warfare last year, which was really pretty incredible. Strongly recommend. And his big theme throughout his career, his first novel was The Beach, which later got turned into this movie directed by Danny Boyle and starring Leonardo DiCaprio. And what is the big idea of The Beach is there's this place outside the law, outside of normal human civilization. And at first it looks like paradise because there's nothing to constrain you there. And it always turns out that it's not paradise. The things go real wrong. And so with the 28 whatever later films, what he has given us is this investigation into anarchy, into what happens when the normal rules of society just break down. And in the very first film, what you see is that sort of people turn lawless. The military takes control, plays on people's fears, and then does awful stuff. And then in the second film, he wasn't involved in that as much. And that's sort of actually kind of about like the international community coming in, and things go wrong from there. But then in the 28 years later movie that came out last year, what you see is that after a long time, Britain starts to reconstitute itself. Like the UK, yes, there's a whole lot that's going wrong, but social order starts to sort of spring up, almost like after, on a volcano, right? Years later, you start to see these green shoots and the world starts to heal. And even in some cases, the zombies themselves start to become part of that order and stop being the threats, the menaces that they were initially perceived to be. And it's sort of kind of fascinating sort of development from somebody who's often made these very sort of negative, cynical, nasty films about human society. And here and later, as he's gotten older, he is saying, well, there's still an awful lot of brutishness in the world, but there's also good. And you see that in The Bone Temple, which is a movie that is a little bit less about sort of the formation of society, but is in fact about the nature of evil. And the nature of evil in this movie is just a guy named Jimmy. And he's based on a real life person named Jimmy Savile, who was a British entertainer, DJ, host type character. Reem, you might be able to clarify this a little bit more for me. But after he died, I think about a decade ago, it came out that he had been involved in just a massive, massive amount of abuse of children, a truly evil human being. And so the villain character in this movie is somebody who is sort of a cult leader who styles himself as the son of the devil. He says his father is Old Nick. But what you see revealed throughout this is there's no devil. There's no Satan. There's nothing mystical. He's just an awful human being who is choosing to be terrible, choosing to be evil, choosing to torture people to death because he thinks it's fun and he gets off on it, and inspiring this sort of action in other people who get their awfulness kind of transferred through him. And so it's kind of a philosophical film in a lot of ways for a movie that is called The Bone Temple and features Ralph Fiennes dressed in leather dancing to Iron Maiden while playing a fictional version of the devil, playing the devil in order to convince the devil's followers to maybe not do what they are doing. Great, great movie. Horrific, gory, not for people who can't stand the strong stuff, but just an absolutely incredible movie that I totally recommend to anybody who has liked Alex Garland's work or the previous 28 whatever years later, 28 something later films. Okay, folks, that is our show. As always, if you like this podcast, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. Thank you so much to Reem and to Kat for guest appearing today. Thank you all so much for listening. The Reason Roundtable will return.